Welcome to Speak Sex. I'm your host, Eve Eurydice. Today's guest is Dimitris Mouyanis. Dimitri is a highly creative individual. He is an artist, an activist, a musician, a writer, a poet, an anarchist, a psychedelic practitioner, and my favorite, a harm reductionist. Welcome to the show, Dimitri.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's wonderful. My pleasure. And a fellow Greek.
Yeah.
From Detroit. So, yeah. Dimitri, you started with photography, collaborating with well-known photographers and in New York, and then you were in a band, right? A punk rock band that became quite successful, influenced by the Beats. And then somehow your life's work became healing addiction using psychedelics as a means to finding balance, right? And you went from like Ibogaine to Cardea. So this journey, which is really what you're known for, how did you embark on it? How did you get from creative, more traditional creative, to like psychedelic creative work?
Yeah, well, through my first plant teachers, which was coca and poppy, heroin and cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
I am born and raised in Detroit. The photographer you're talking about is Misha Gordon, the late Misha Gordon.
Yes.
Who I suggest people check out. And he was one of my early influences, but I was, born and raised in Detroit, born in 1962, and there was it was a fertile ground for many things, as Detroit is for music and art and politics and also drugs. So when I grew up in the 60s and 70s, everyone was doing drugs of some kind.
At least
the people I knew.
Yeah.
And so, what started out as, youthful exploration and also and creativity and also an enhancement of life and also a solve for pain, and curiosity and over the course of, 20 plus years, 20 with opiates and cocaine, there's a skinaki in the background.
Yeah.
20 plus years of heroin and cocaine, eventually, overtook my life. In many ways, my drug use, which started very young, was a way to explore and enhance, as you say. And what happened eventually is this Faustian bargain that you make with something that gives you so much, and heroin can give you so much, that by the time it was over with, my life became very small. So I went from being a creative person and moved to New York. I met my heroes and hung out with my heroes. I lived with Herbert Hunky and got high with Gregory Corso and several other musicians, lived in the Hotel Chelsea, was playing on a regular basis. But and at first the heroin was very helpful for that, but then eventually I became the ultimate consumer. And
at first it expanded you and made you so big, and then by becoming dependent, it kind of shrunk you. Right,
yeah,
you made it so small that you were all you could think of was the drug, right?
Yeah, the drug and the release from suffering, which at first it gave me, but then just amplified. And I was mixing cocaine and heroin, injecting it. So there's a great deal of psychosis involved in the injection of cocaine. And the other thing was that a young person in lower Manhattan in the 80s and 90s, there was a whole uptick in heroin use, but there was also, the HIV AIDS epidemic that hit that area pretty profoundly in targeted that area in one of the highest rates of death and infection in the world. And so my friends who were either drug users or were men who had sex with men or women, queer people and women, and were dying at a very high rate.
Yeah,
And
I was
so
there at the time, I remember it. It was just, it was a dystopia. It was very difficult psychically. So I can imagine why the, the drug was more important than ever.
It was. And then, more and more people were dying in my life and continue to die. And so, I went from this sort of big, expensive, creative life to returning home to Detroit and living in my parents' basement, consuming over $200 of heroin a day,
Wow.
heroin and cocaine, and parking cars for a living, and turning 40. And I had the desire, a profound desire, a hunger to go to my ancestral homeland, which was Greece, particularly the island of Ikaria, which my father's side, that's where they're from. And I haven't been able to go because of my habit. So I had heard about Iboga. I should say it was a dystopia, but there was also a creative energy that was happening in the 80s and 90s in New York, and maybe the last gasp of what we could call sort of traditional bohemia.
Oh yeah,
You
for sure,
know,
for sure.
yeah, I don't know if that's available to young people. I don't think it is
I
in the
don't think
same
it's
way.
available. Yeah. I mean,
Yeah, I.
death definitely, death like feeds that.
That's what?
Death, a lot of death and devastation feeds that creativity, that creative energy.
And it was sort of a battle zone, And then at the same time, there was the amping up of the drug wars, mass incarceration. There was the beginning of, the gentrification of New York was, and the whole country was sped up, and drug wars were used as an excuse to occupy communities. So there was the struggles on the Lower East Side
And
where I
also
was living.
that kind of like new creepy Puritanism, the kind of like sex and death connection that we had forgotten about. We had just been liberated like for a minute, and suddenly, like the patriarchal morals were, finding reason to come back, right? Because of course sex
Well,
could kill.
because sex could kill, and we've got to remember, we should never forget that the Democratic leadership in the state of New York, Cuomo and Koch,
Oh
at the
yeah,
same time
Koch, yeah.
they closed the bathhouses, and instead of going in and educating, they simply closed it as if sex will not happen, and then they restricted access to syringes and syringe, and they held that stupid position for years and years. And so there was this pushback, the rise of Reaganism, the rise of the Christian right,
And I think it was, so strongly linked to that disease. It actually, when COVID happened, it made me remember that time, because it was a similar time of like a sudden, pandemic was hitting us hard, and it was related with things so fundamental like, sex. Especially all of a sudden, people couldn't have unprotected sex. Like we had just got birth control, we had just started having unprotected sex. What are you talking about? men, like the queer scene had just found itself because people didn't need to be like domesticated in order to procreate, I mean, all of this had just changed, and suddenly we're dying because of it. And the solution is to just like like wear condoms and mind who you sleep with. And it was just consciousness altering, very similar to this pandemic that happened to us recently, that we still don't know how it changed us. Yeah, and as you said, I mean, thank you for noting that, but like Reagan, the resurgence of like Christian communities and moralities and everything that has gone on since then, began with AIDS, in my opinion.
Yeah, I want to make a few comments on what you just said,
Yes,
because
please.
So yes, there was a similarity to the pandemic, and as much as as much as we might hate to admit it, some folks in populist movements were right about the way that the states used the pandemic as a tool of repression.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, we had passed laws that didn't really even tighten up, and in more so-called liberal states, it was more odious. Like you couldn't go to school unless you were vaccinated, and access to to public accommodations. So that's one aspect, and I would say that, and we always have to remember that public health can be used as a weapon of state power too.
Oh, 100%. I mean, this, I think that, Big Pharma, the way that, everybody had to take that vaccine, the way that all of that was used. And it's so, and the other similarity, by the way, is that when, during the AIDS crisis, I mean, at least in my community, I'm sure in yours too, everybody was debating HIV. It was very similar to how, how now the people who had been were called conspiracy theorists, the people who were doubting the mainstream narrative about COVID, something like that was happening at the time. I
Oh,
was
yeah.
actually writing for Spin magazine, and we were doing series of articles, discrediting the mainstream view of how contagious it is sexually and all of that. So
Yeah. We also it did start with, there was Reagan did start with Reagan, but we have to remember the just one of the Clintons' legacies of death and ignorance that still plagues places like Haiti and but we gotta remember Clinton, who had a there was a beautiful attorney general, Jocelyn, and I'm forgetting her last name. She was a black woman. Forgive me for forgetting it. But the way that when she came out in favor of needle syringe access, which people should remember that at that time, if you were an injecting drug user like I was, and also had tons of queer friends, but anyways, an injecting drug user like I was in a place like New York, I forget what the rate of infection is, but something like 4 in 10 or something like that. And a simple act, and by the way, then it meant a death sentence. And simple access to clean and sterile injection equipment could and eventually did reverse course. But Clinton went
Oh
against
yeah,
his
Joycelyn Elders, yeah.
Josh, yeah, she was just a brilliant woman. And when she came out in favor of syringe access, and then she said something about masturbation being normal, they used that. And this is the guy who was, getting blowjobs in the White House. They used that as a way to destroy her career, and then came after her son and charged him with a cocaine conspiracy within months. So and she lost her position. So and then we also have to remember the Clintons allowed their staff to wear gloves when greeting members of the LGBTQ community. So just to say, yes, Reagan, and then and then the continuation with
Oh yeah,
that's
oh
just the continuation of the same shit.
yeah.
So
And the
one of
spreading,
the
the spreading of panic, which is how they control the population through this like fear of the unknown. Well, we don't know, we never know enough, you
Well,
just
and
that sort of thing that they keep
Yeah,
doing.
and who was dying? It was queer men, it was IV drug users, and at a high rate, black women. And so, in a way, I remember someone saying it was a disease of the hip. It was a disease of the people in New York, So one of the things that happened during that period, which was as significant as anything that in terms of my transformation and healing, was that I was, I don't know if you remember, there was a place, the gas station on the corner of Second and B. Anyways, yeah, I was basically the house band there for years. And it was a sculpture park of an old gas station. Anyways, in front of that place, right next to Save the Robots, they used to sell hypodermic syringes on the corner. That's where you would go and get them. And often I would get them and they would be sealed. And I'd open it up and I'd push it and the little water would come out, which means they resealed it. In the middle of that pandemic, they might have cleaned it with bleach, or something like that. But it was a big risk. And so I was taking a risk because I was at that point where I couldn't stop and I couldn't stop injecting. And I remember coming on that corner and there was a small table set up. And I knew of ACT UP, the silence equals death. And for the younger people, the people who don't know, they should look up ACT UP. Their slogan, silence equals death. Yeah, and they were there and they had bags and information. And there were all these gay guys, basically. And I was looking for the regular syringe guys, and I came to the table and they handed me a bag full of syringes and some information. And then I asked them how much did I owe them, and they said, we just want you to be safe. Yeah. And these men were many of them were arrested for doing that. They were risking jail time because it was against the law to give people that. And that act of kindness and radical service, and just acknowledging me as a human being at a time where like I was a pariah, it still moves me. And I tell that story often, and it still moves me. And so that's when I got involved in the harm reduction movement, soon after Lower East Side harm reduction needle exchange was open.
ACT UP was like the Larry Kramer made that famous, right?
Was Larry Kramer. And then there was the whole drug user part of it that came up from that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, soon after there was a storefront opened, and that was the first place I went in to get my access to syringes. And there was a conversation about legalization and decriminalization and drug users' rights and the things that I was thinking about, but had never heard anyone in any sort of at least organized fashion articulate. So that was, I guess, probably 91.
Wow.
And there's a miracle that I'm HIV negative, and a real miracle that I'm hepatitis C negative. But from then on, I credit that with the harm reduction movement and the brave and good work that, you know, not only like queer men, but active drug users started and propelled that movement, which is similar to the Ibogaine movement, because it was drug users that really moved it. And it sort of came up around in terms of in sort of tandem, you know. That's I found out about Ibogaine through the harm reduction scene on the Lower East Side, which was a very politicized space. It wasn't just art that was happening in New York. It was very political.
Mm-hmm.
It was.
So when did you start on it? In Detroit, you started.
Started with drugs?
No,
Ibogaine. No. Well, what happened was, I 1991, I had a conversation on Lower East Side with my friend Adam Nodelman, who had just gotten back from a couple months before from an Ibogaine session in Holland. And he was telling me about this strange thing. And, you know, he had found out about it through the work of Yippie Dana Beale. And it was Howard and Norma Lutzoff, who were sort of the mother and father of the Ibogaine movement in the United States. And he was telling me about this thing, and his girlfriend at the time, or his wife at the time, Herta, was there, and my wife was there. And by the way, Adam and my wife both ended up succumbing to the addiction. They talked about this thing, this African root plant that had, at least temporarily, and I think that's really significant to say that they were injecting again, and Adam eventually died from the heroin overdose, but that they were telling me about this thing that could, after a deep psychedelic experience, a deep and arduous one, it's one of the longest psychedelics, that, you know, they were, as they said, returned to a pre-addictive state. I don't know how true that is, but they said that they came through a detox and with the difficulty of Iboga, but with some sort of renewed purpose, even though they were injecting, and they were advocates for it. And that's the first time I heard about it. Subsequently, you know, it was sort of urban legend in the Lower East Side and harm reduction spaces and spaces of the people who did drugs. And, you know, you'd hear about someone going off to Holland or Panama or something and doing it. But it always seemed like this exotic, unapproachable thing. And actually, frankly, I wasn't really interested at the time. I wasn't ready for it, or it didn't appeal to me. And the other thing about a junkie, a problematic opiate user, is the last thing they want to do his experience, it's that kind of opening. I don't know if you know the artist Rennie Ricard. Do you know Rennie Ricard? Yeah, he said he's a pretty funny guy. He said when he was told about Iboga, he said he would like the doors of his perception tightly closed. So that's kind of where I was at, and it wasn't until a decade later that I was, back in Detroit, in the basement of my parents' house. Like I said to you yesterday, we have an incredibly beautiful codependent culture. There's nothing that we could do to get me thrown out of that house or out of my parents' house. And
Nothing,
yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely nothing. I was, my common-law wife, Barbara, had died pregnant. I had all this death around me from overdose, murder, actually. Several of my friends were killed, HIV/AIDS. My life had become very small. I ceased. I wasn't writing anymore. I wasn't involved politically. I was my idea was just the drug. I was sort of coming to the end, and I wanted to go to Greece. And then my first thought in the morning was suicide. My last thought in the evening was suicide. And so slowly I began to, pursue the idea, and then the idea became a reality. My family, who didn't have a lot of money at the time, got the money together, and I went off to Holland to
Detox.
detox. I went to Amsterdam, which at the time, Amsterdam was sort of the Mecca for, at least in our minds, for drug users. So I went just outside of Amsterdam, it took a while, but I got there, and with the idea of going to Amsterdam and then immediately going to Greece, and then I would just come back after a month and finish the job, so to speak. But God had other plans. Iboga had other plans. Maybe Bleaky had other plans. So yeah, that's what brought me to Holland, and I could, and I went with my brother, who came with me because he's like, we're not giving you a couple $1,000 and send you to Holland. I didn't have a passport. I didn't have anything, right? And I showed up at this sort of ramshackle, beautiful farmhouse on in Brooklyn, or Brooklyn as we call it. About 40 minutes outside of Amsterdam, and there were canals and a windmill, and it was like, and this hippie lady, Sarah Glatt, and Sarah, yeah, Sarah was a Israeli woman with this frizzy hair and six kids, and was smoking a joint when I showed up. Her mother was there, and she kind of she, Persian Jewish, and so she kind of they kind of looked she kind of looked like us. You know what I mean? And so I felt at home with the yaya there, and we I had got drunk on the plane, so I was a little bit of drunk, and I was in the beginning of withdrawals, which I later learned was where you had to be. So I was there. I knew that I was going to get sick, and I was going to try this thing, and we I did, and it was 3 days of difficult because Iboga is difficult because the journey is difficult, and difficult because I was detoxing. But I have to say, in my case, I didn't experience it as withdrawal. It might have looked like withdrawal from the outside, the vomiting and that type of things, but I wasn't craving. And they have to keep giving me more to sort of push the withdrawal out. But I saw all kinds of things in past, present, and future. And I will say that I had no desire to use, and I haven't had it since. And I want to stop right here and say, after doing, giving, administering Iboga, ibogaine to over 500 drug users, that is the one of the least likely outcomes is never to use again. I think that's a maybe a 10 to 20% Right. And there's a reason why I fell into that 10 or 20%. I think is what happened afterwards. But just really quickly, it was just this profound experience where sort of saw my ancestors in the Peloponnese on my mother's side, and saw my teachers in the future, and saw that I would be doing things like I'm doing right now. Saw specifically, this is really weird and specific, and I would say, as the kids say, random. I saw that I would be on This American Life, for instance. I knew that I would be an Ivy game provider. I saw my teacher in Gabon, and I didn't know who he was at the time. And then, I went through this profound experience where the dead came to me from the past. I was in my grandmother's kitchen. I saw my common-law wife. I saw my buddy Paul, who was the first to OD. And then I was washed away of the shame and the guilt for my wife's death. And then I was able to sort of witness sexual trauma as a kid and sort of be good with that and release the shame around that. And I woke up and crawled out literally every orifice. I had shit and puked and came and cried and sneezed and yawned and for 3 days, crawled out while everyone was sleeping. I was well taken care of. The kids would come in and check on me. I was in a little girl's, like a teenage preteen girl's room, with pictures of pop stars and soccer players on the wall. And I was in this room for those 3 days. I lost count of the sunrises and sundowns. And at night, the room would be filled with the sounds of the frogs from the canals. And I had visions of frog orgies and like
So, like, I
insane.
think that, yeah, you definitely had like a psychic, a psychic death and resurrection, kind of you go through the underworld and you come back.
And the voice from my ancestor, a matriarch, just saying, dead so long, the earth's gone through you. And that became a mantra for me. And it's changed what it, the meaning of it has changed. And then the next day I woke up, and the next day, 3, 4 days, 3.5 days, I guess it was sunrise, and everyone was asleep. And I crawled out of there and somehow made it and washed myself in the tub. And then I dressed really, I was really wobbly. I was kicking methadone, cocaine, and heroin. And I walked outside and I went for a walk in the rising dew, in the dew and the rising sun. And I fell in the field because I was used to walking on flat surfaces and the tall grass. And I laid in that dew and my pockets emptied and there was money on the ground. And I was just laying there for a while, and then I gathered myself and went back in and just wept for hours, and was just repeating praise God over and over again. And it took months of rehabilitation. Then I went to Greece, and that's and I went to my grandmother's village, and I could tell that story, but I think that was as equally important to my early recovery as the Ibogaine itself. I was able to go and see where I'm from and see who I am. And so I stayed in the village before the Americans come, the Greek Americans or people from Athens or Germany. Before, it was just the old people, and before, when in the late fall, I mean late spring, just the old people were there. I bathed and just slowly recovered.
Yeah, no, I think that Greece has a lot of healing power, especially the islands, because of this continuity, like you feel like you step back a couple of thousand years, nothing really has changed. And so there is a lot of safety and stability in that land, in that kind of continuity, like nothing gets to that place.
And the Kadiotis, the people of that island, are particularly known for that. They're also known for being a little weird and laid back, even more laid back than some of the other islands. I mean, it's and I was able, exactly that. There was this continuity that I could see people that looked like me. They had fingernails like me. They had the same type of jokes. They shared my politics, which was
Yes,
awesome, a lot of
exactly. Yes,
them.
yes, yes.
They would say, let's go bother Katina today instead of let's go visit. Let's go bother her. Little things like that. And there was a moment, and I'm going to screw it up because my Greek's so bad, but I was walking in the village and this woman was coming, walking towards me, and she had the gait of my grandmother, who had long since passed. I used to call my grandmother John Wayne, by the way. She'd walk like sort of one foot to the other, and she was walking by, and you know that Greek stare, or they're with sort of unconscious, with no self-conscious, just staring at you,
Of
right?
course.
Especially the old
Everybody
ladies, they're
stares.
just,
Super,
just staring at you. Right. And she's walking towards me, and I say, "Yasa," and she says, "Pianus ise." And I thought she was asking me who I was. Now, do I have that right? What she was asking me, whose I was, right?
Pianu. Pianu is
Yeah,
it.
pianu,
Piano.
pianu is it. Yeah, pianu is it.
Oh
Yeah,
yeah, that
and
is the
that.
question. I get that everywhere. I don't wanna,
Yeah,
like, who do you belong to?
exactly? And I didn't understand the question. It took me a minute, and then I explained who my grandfather was and who my grandmother was, and I could see her making the calculation in my head, her head, and she told me my grandmother baptized her. And once she had fixed me as actually belonging to her in some way, she just went on her way. And that question, whose am I, was sort of the theme of that entire trip, and the ancestral connection with Iboga and Bwiti. I didn't even know it at the time, but there was somehow an ancestral healing was happening. So yeah, and the whole
Nice.
time I was thinking about coming back and giving other people the Iboga. Yeah.
So
Yeah.
then, and then you ended up in Gabon. Is that what you told me? Where you got initiated?
Eventually,
Oh, eventually, okay.
eventually what happened is I went back to Detroit. My mentor at the time, Richie O'Glovnik, said, "You want to work with Iboga? Everyone does afterwards. Why don't you take a couple of pick a year and get stable." And what I wanted to do was just provide it for people who couldn't leave the country. And eventually I went to New York and back to New York after a year of sort of stabilizing myself. And we started to like really just really sort of in the open give out Iboga, even though it was a felony. And in the process of and so we were doing it in hotel rooms and in people's homes, and we were doing it for very little money. It was kind of crazy. And I detoxed people with Iboga and like I said, in a very public way. I ended up on This American Life, like I said I would. That's all I would. But I ended up, becoming this practitioner and being very public about it. And there was a point of the filmmaker Michel Negroponte, also Greek American, started to, he had just finished a film called Methadonia about methadone. And someone told him about Iboga, and he found me, and he was filming, and there was a moment of someone almost died, and we thought maybe we should go to the source of it. So that got me to Gabon, and maybe 18 years ago, and I
Oh,
was
okay.
initiated in three different levels of Bwiti, over the course of six trips to Gabon, and then it influenced the way I did my practice. Greatly, but what was missing, I thought, was that it wasn't authentically me. And in fact, after a while, I just had to realize that I am this Greek boy from Detroit. I am not a Gabonese healer, and what could I bring into, before I went to Gabon, I was just administering the drug the way Sarah did it for me in a dark room and taking care of people, which is a huge task, actually.
Well,
Later,
yeah,
I started.
being present for them, and it's a risk. I mean,
Oh, so there's,
being
yeah.
present for that, it's a, that's why you call it radical service. The radical part of it is that, people are broken and you hold them in, like you have power. It's not yours, but in that moment,
Oh no, there is a
right?
great deal of power. That's
Yeah, you have a
something I
lot
don't
of
think.
power.
And what I started to see was that. Well, first of all, in the ceremonial aspect of it, I was like, it just hit me, like, because I was a musician and I had after-hours clubs with my brother, and when I first got back to Detroit, after Iboga, I was doing house nights and stuff like that. But what I saw was that they were creating space in which, and the space involved sound, and the space involved repetitive sound, and the sound was the same sound that saved my life in rock and roll and jazz and in hip hop and in house and all that stuff. The music I loved was there, and they had created these communities that this has been going on for 700 years in Gabon or longer, where at least the Bantu experienced 700 years, where there was this sacrament, much like ayahuasca or peyote, which was the central sacrament, and then the pharmacopoeia of the surrounding forest, as you know, that they use in the healing, and a deep knowledge of that, and then an understanding the ancestral entities and the ancestral spells, as they would call them. We would call them inheritances or whatever, and then also the performing arts as healing art. And that was what was holding everyone. It's almost like Bali. Everyone's an artist in Gabon. And so I went home like
I can
just
hear New
struck by
York
that.
City behind you.
Yeah,
Canal Street, I can
yeah,
hear
Canal Street here at
it.
Cardea. You know, we do live sound here, and I always just say, look, we're gonna have New York in the room with us, that which is part of our ceremony. So, you know, I came back and I started to replicate what I learned in Gabon, and I did that for a while, and I went back and forth. And by the way, I'm an initiator in Bliki, but I am by no means an initiator of anyone. I'm very even a very good student of Bliki. I'm really grateful for Bliki. But what I realized was that this was not mine, and that I do have my own heritage, and then I have the collective heritage of being an American, and the incredible art from these two continents, which actually comes from that continent, right? I mean, the Americas, and then mixed with immigrants from all over. And so what I realized is that I like the idea of ceremony. I like beginnings, middles, and ends. I know that from being an organizer and creating community space like I've done in Harlem and other places. I like the idea of space more than I am more interested in space than I am the drugs. And that started to I started to move my practice. And then around the same, and then after, and then I eventually I got arrested by the DEA, which took my magic powder away, and I started to create space at the needle exchange, called at that time called the Syringe Access, I should say, and the harm reduction center called New York Harm Reduction Educators, which eventually became On Point. And I
Ah, okay,
started
on
to,
point, yeah.
anyway, I'm going really quick here, just
Well,
but oh, maybe slow. I mean,
I'm interested, I wanted to touch on something. I don't know if we've passed it or not in your story. No, I think you're a great storyteller, but we were talking about yesterday about the medical gaze, and you extended it to the shamanic gaze. So I don't know if we've, I'm
yeah,
interested in that,
I'm
because
happy.
we were just talking about ceremony. And we agree that, like, the medical gaze mentioned by Foucault, that we're very familiar with right now through Big Pharma, is damaging. But you mentioned this shamanic gaze is also potentially damaging in the sense of it being very rigid and ceremonial and authoritative, and like you have to get through the shaman and only the shaman to get better. So it also turns the human into like a patient or a thing, right? So yeah, I just want you to touch on that. And I don't know if that was part of this experience or if it came.
It was eventually it was when I was, you know, I have a healthy you know, well, what Chomsky talked about when people basically anarchism 101 is that no authority is self-justifying, so you have to justify your authority, and the higher the authority, the higher the standard of justification should be. And so it's pretty high when it comes to something like psychedelics or medicine in general. So you know, just as you said, just like an allopathic approach, something is wrong with you, and we're going to fix it this way, and here's the prescriptive ways of doing it. You know, there is a justification for that hierarchy if we're talking about a broken bone, and they can prove sort of inconclusively that. I mean, conclusively that is in fact the right way to go. But when we're talking about matters of the spirit, of psyche, of psychiatry, they have not been able to do that. The opposite is true. And then the medical gaze will turn someone into a patient, right? And just so the same thing with the shaman or the Ayurvedic healer or the Chinese medicine healer. They're going to look at you as the thing. And even though they're incorporating all kinds of maybe a more holistic approach, the funnel, the channel through which the healing would come would be the shaman and would be the structure, right?
Right, right.
So, you
And
know.
the human becomes more and more compartmentalized and fractured, you know, like let me do this part of the body and then that part of the body.
Or becomes a thing.
Right.
Or becomes, to be fixed.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I think to be fixed. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, but we also, in the midst of our culture, and we have this incredible need, this need born of pain of modernity to invent ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that calls for this beautiful thing called improvisation.
Mm-hmm.
And freedom within the arts.
Yeah.
So I say that we're, you know, at Cardea, for instance, I say we're medically supported, but we're not medicalized. We're appreciative of the knowledge of the traditional holders of psychedelic medicines, but we're not shamans. We are in the middle. So we don't come from Johns Hopkins and we don't come from the forest. We come from the dance floor. We come from the gallery. We come from the theater. Mm. We come from the book. We come from the podium, right?
Mm.
We come from, so our sort of cultural ancestors are, you know, O'Keefe or Whitman or Holiday or Parker or Sun Ra. These are the masters of plasticity in the way we move. They talk about neuroplasticity, which I don't know anything about. But what I know that when I'm in a space, and I dig the container of ceremony, some of my friends don't like the word ceremony. If they don't want to use it, we just call it a session. But there's a beginning, a middle, and end, which I saw in Gabon executed, by the way, brilliantly and with such skill and mastery as healers and artists. And so that arc, which I understood as a performer, and then creating a container that is secure and safe and honoring the person, which I think is most of what's happening there more than anything else, is this absolute commitment to the honoring, what I call radical hospitality, the honoring of this person, right? And
and
hold it in a non-formulaic space and in a non-formulaic way where we use sound, which a lot of people are, most ceremonies use sound or music, right?
Yes.
The idea of sound, but in we don't even use an identifiable language until maybe 6 hours into it. And the idea is to immerse someone in that container of the sound. And like a good jazz improv, we have the container, like Funny Valentine is the container of the song, and you can play within that, and we're playing within the container, and the most important thing we can do is be attuned to the person receiving. So what I saw happen with the Ibogaine world was that I was doing all these detoxes, and the only end result was the cessation of drug use. Was a cessation of problematic drug use, which happened less than it did. It didn't happen more than it did, right? So most people were going back to using, and they were failures. And by the way, psychedelics create the ultimate failures by all this bullshit hype around it, right? If you still are in a ruminative state later on in life, somehow you failed, even though, you know, the results from this study or that study prove that, you know, PTSD, apparently you can kill people or experience evil, and in three doses with a therapist, like the evil, you know, you're cured. And the same thing with Ibogaine. They were telling folks that, and they're still saying that this is going to cure you, and it's ignoring how beautifully complex and fragile and frustrating and poetic we are, right?
Yes.
We're not, and so even if someone uses again. These are not, this is the way Ibogaine is being sort of advertised. It's not a harm reduction model. It's saying there's one outcome. I'm saying there's thousands of outcomes.
Right.
And if they're coming to Dimitri,
well, yeah, because
they
that way you free the person from this duality of like success and failure, and both of which are self-defeating and just, you know, inventions of like late capitalism, you know, that makes like life itself a matter of success and failure. What?
Yeah, you can't be an artist these days and be a failure. Like the point, like these some of the kids, they're like totally frightened about if you make art, you're a success.
Yeah.
Right? If you come and you do it, people ask me what was the success rate? The success rate was 100%. 100% of the people that come to me to do psychedelics. It's 100%. I mean, after we screen folks and everything, what happens, you know, by the way, it could be a bad trip and maybe not productive. We have to acknowledge that too. There are bad trips, right? But you bring up a very good point. This is a production. They're putting it into a production line, right? And so they come to find the golden, the chalice, the fountain of youth. And then, they leave still hurt, still confused, still anxious. And what else are they gonna be? If you're not anxious right now and hurt and confused, then perhaps you're not paying attention,
That's right.
right?
Then you're not sensitive. And if you're go seeking psychedelics, you're sensitive. You're picking up a lot more than you know, and you're an instrument.
Well, but then they leave and they make return to the behavior, and then they must be extra broken because the MAPS studies and the NYU studies, and I saw Dimitri talking about his success, and I saw this one in the New York Times, and I must be broken. And the reality is that you are not broken, and we're not trying to fix you. We were
Exactly.
trying maybe have a relationship with your substances, a relationship with your rumination, a relationship with your anxiety, and maybe something can change, or maybe
Change.
not.
Yeah, exactly. I
Yeah,
mean,
and maybe not. And look, I'll just say this. One of the things I love about psychedelics, particularly iboga, is that how inefficient it is. It takes so many people to do it. It lasts a long time. We don't know the outcome, but in that time, we can spend time with people and honor them and love them in a way that late stage capitalism does not allow. It is not allowed. And so, but they're trying to figure out how to squeeze this in.
Oh,
So,
for sure. I mean, look what's happening. It's everywhere. Between the ketamine clinics and you order microdosing kits, it's just now so monetized. Yeah, the collective ritual experience, is being taken out of it more and more. If you look at how it's advertised, it's like you and a person, who probably is not even certified, and that's it. You go in, you get out, or you do it at home. I mean, it's just,
Well, that's one of the things at Kardeia that we've been challenging. We
Good.
don't, we'll go back to Foucault, right? With the clinic, the idea of a clinic is to move a body through, right? Here, we have a ketamine space. It's a space, and it's an art space, and we make art here with people. And we and you don't come in for an hour and gone. You might be here for 3 hours. You might be here for 4 hours. It's not a great business model, but it's a great healing model, right?
Right,
And
good.
our retreats were, were about exploration and not sort of results oriented. I mean, on the retreats, someone is in the throne of an extreme event of mood or mind or grappling with something extreme. It's not a place for a retreat. That might be happening in our space here in lower Manhattan. But that's why I eventually left the ibogaine work. I was burnt out for one. I detoxed around 500 people, and then I got arrested by the DEA for detoxing a drug user.
I know.
And I so I had a federal case, and then I eventually found my way to working more with sound. I was influenced by my friend, the great Alexander Tunnis, who's just brilliant sound master and musician and brilliant guy, and his work with sound, and started working with MDMA and psilocybin, which I did for, I don't know, maybe 13 years. The work overlapped 14 years. And then eventually found my way to working with Ross Ellenhorn here at Kardeia. But the idea is that space is the place. Space holding is the prime
Exactly.
importance, and relationship is prime importance.
And community, like not being alone is really important. Being, kind of like exchanging energy with the, with the collective, when you kind of go into the feeling of the human condition. So it's not, me, like me, the individual who like don't fit in, or who are broke, who I'm broken, or who I'm hurt, by becoming kind of like one of many, I think, is also very, very healing. Like I remember doing transformational breathing, all different types of transformational breathing, but the point is it's so much more empowering. Like you go so m much more out of body when it's a big group of people. You know, it's if you have like 50 people doing it at once, it's wild. And if you have like 3 people, or of course if you're doing it alone with a private, you know, person tutor, it's nothing. It's so you pay much more money to do it alone, because in our, you know, sad, lonely culture nowadays, we like value that. But in fact, you know, if the more people you can do this stuff with, the more you will find healing in, you know, through each other.
Yeah, yeah. We offer you know, the retreats are groups, and then we offer individual, but we also offer groups here. And it's with, by the way, it's with live sound often, where we're playing for someone's ketamine experience.
Oh, that's nice.
With like really amazing, Juan McLean is our musical sound director. And we play, I just did someone, we just did a session just a little while ago.
Wait to come and see it.
You got to come and experience it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll give you a diagnosis, but we'll run it through the doctor.
Okay.
but I think what you're talking about, I mean, there is the oneness, and that there's also a danger in that, as we know, of losing, you know, sort of an authoritarian space. But to be able to be with others is also incredibly important. And I think you bring up, you know, this, what you just said just touched on, I think, a really important point around sort of the atomization of pain and the conversation around trauma, which I think is an important conversation and an important recognition, but the way it's become a totality, it reminds me of sort of a nationalism. That, you know, that at my core is a historic pain. Brought about by an event, or events, and then the boundaries I need are these huge boundaries, and any violation of those boundaries is a violation of that core pain, which is identity, and then the identification with the trauma, and then the identification with the diagnoses. I see some young people who put, you know, ADHD in their profiles, you know, like that's who they are, the sort of random DSM nonsense. But like that trauma becomes this animizing sort of individualizing element and empowering at first, I think. But then, you know, just like the identification for the person in the 12-step program, which I owe a lot to 12-step programs, but for me, the continual going back to addict became the same thing. Sort of that's not me. That's this thing, and that's a description. And so, what is missing in that conversation is what you pointed to, which is what used to be called alienation.
Right.
And being alienated from one's species essence.
Right.
In the place of work, right. In the way we communicate, and so it's giving the greater container sort of a pass, and the idea that we can simply inject sort of psychedelics into that alienating system and somehow change it is a ridiculous idea, and actually sort of dangerous. And I think it is, you know, sort of taking out it is answering a tendency that may occur within psychedelic spaces of liberation, but the tendency is feared, and therefore it is suppressed either consciously or unconsciously. But the result is a medicalization, a commodification, and a militarization in order to gain legitimacy and to gain market and to gain trust. But ultimately, it becomes just another tool of social control.
And this is what worries me. Yeah,
I mean,
I think that too. Everything in the end becomes or can become a tool of social control, you know, as we experience right now. I mean, this past 4 years with the current administration are like, you know, all the proof we need that our best intentions and our best ideas can be used, you know, to control us. But I do think also like we have, I think in this you know, in this time that we live, in the beginning of this millennium, like a huge amount of historic trauma, because there is a huge amount of change. You know, we have like, we underwent like the collapse of patriarchy, basically, which, you know, it was a terrible system, but nevertheless, it was the system everybody knew for many, many generations, for thousands of years. So that ended, right? Everything became secularized. You know, scientism like replaced for most people, you know, spirituality and religion. And then we entered the digital era, like the digital revolution. So, and the accelerationism, right? And now, or even the conversation about transhumanism. So all of this has happened in a historical like split second, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we are alienated both from like what you said, our species essence, but also like our recent social conditioning. So people mm-hmm. like, no one knows how to be.
This is the challenge. This is the challenge. And I think artists answered it. And that doesn't mean that everyone needs to be that artist, but to with a capital A. But I think, God, to be somehow comfortable, not even comfortable, to somehow navigate that fear. When the fires were happening last summer, right?
Mm-hmm.
I came to the Cardale offices, and the younger people, brilliant young people, were here. And I won't say who it is, but a young person who, incredibly talented clinician, he came in, and as the guy with the gray beard, I walked in, and he's like, "I'm really glad you're here." I mean, the sky was red. I was coughing, thick with smoke. And he was looking for me as the elder for some comfort. And he said, like, "This is like, Dimitri, like, I'm really scared." And I was just like, "Fuck yeah, I'm fucking terrified. This is terrifying. The sky is on fire. But what do we do with that? What do we do when the sky is on fire?"
Right.
And I think maybe, but the thing about it is, we talked about Marcuse yesterday in our conversation.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that late stage capital will, you know, as our friend Varoufakis says, techno feudalism will mm-hmm. assume and consume every notion. So what we have to do is use that improvisational spark that has
right.
kept us alive yeah. for the last 200 years, as this modernity is, and go from there. I think that we can requeer psychedelics, capital A, small A. I think we can requeer art and as a social disruption, and not as some sort of just some shock show for the ultra-rich and miseducated. You know, but as a way for organizing, you know, and understanding what emerging classes, in the sort of the class war, what is emerging, and how to use these technologies for that. And so, part of what I'm doing is we started at Cardale. We had something called the Further Fund, which is an effort to support those people who are making change in the world and who are under attack, and not only just from burnout, but just maybe to a renewed sense of curiosity. I think the opposite of depression or anxiety is curiosity. It's what saved you and I. And we've had one mm-hmm. phone call, but I know it saved you. Because
yeah.
you woke up every morning or every other morning, maybe you were in bed for 3 weeks, mm-hmm. with, unable to move, but something, some curiosity of creativity sparked you to create. And if we could support folks like that. So what we started doing was we're calling Heal the Healers. And the first program is for veterans of the war on drugs, meaning the folks who have been at the ass end of the war on drugs, either incarcerated or just a witness or directly affected. But we're starting with people who work in the harm reduction centers and people who work in drop-in centers for homeless folks and people who work overdose prevention and talking to families and folks with people who have died. And we're offering ketamine therapy in our ethos of a creative, expansive way of doing mm-hmm. it. And so we have 70 participants so far. We're all getting 3 to 4 sessions, including our therapeutic dialogics, and what we want to do is support those folks. And we've expanded. We've been working with some special ed teachers, and now climate change scientists and activists. And you know what I would like to see it do is to support those who are in the classrooms and in the drop-ins and in the laboratories and in the theaters who are working to make change and to support that alien, to support those who are affected by that alienation and the trauma of all this change that you described. And I think that we need to re-queer it, meaning re-politicize it in a way that these medicines can, in a way that they've been used in the past. Certainly they've been used to do the opposite, but we also know that substances have been used at the center of organizing, whether it's tobacco or alcohol in the coffee shop or the pub. I think of the coal miners in Wales who would go and drink together and then sing, you know what I mean? As an organizing tool. So that's
Oh,
just one example. So
yeah, like
that's my idea.
adaptogenic. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, I think the most beautiful message of all of this is the beauty and the power in, being able to like improvise. The improvisational aspect of it, I think it's like the intangible, ineffable, intuitive capacity to like to morph, and that's how we will outsmart our AI and our current selves, and we will just keep evolving in ways that we can't even imagine right now. So that's our superpower, is in that improvisation.
That is the superpower, and the enemy of that super, the kryptonite, is best practices, and is a rigid way of seeing it. And so the job, my job, has been, working in the psychedelic space for 22 years and working with thousands of people, is to be attuned to the individual of the group. Just like an artist is, just like a therapist is, just like a teacher is, just like a parent is, to be attuned to what is happening, and to be able to make changes and move and be plastic in those moments. Yeah, but you're right. I'm strangely optimistic. I don't fucking know why. The
Yeah,
sky's
me
on fire. I
too.
just saw it.
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly. It is on fire. Yeah. Well, thank you, Dimitri. This was beautiful. And
Matt.
what an amazing conversation. What an amazing way to look at the opioid crisis and say, hey, there is a solution. There is lots of hope. There is lots of positive stuff happening. Yeah. So thank you again, and everyone out there, thank you for listening. And until next week, speak sex, speak love, speak healing.
Be still, my.